So I'm delighted to welcome Alex Tebellaman this evening. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you. Good evening. My own encounter with Merton began after I survived a bone marrow transplant for leukemia that nearly took my life in 1984. Looking the reality of death in the face prepared me to engage Merton's call to encounter reality as it is. Little did I know that his writing would draw me into the calling that I attempt to live today. It was in this context, when I was in divinity school studying both Thomas Merton and Dr. Martin Luther King, that I attended a conference in 1988 at the Aquinas Center for Roman Catholic Studies at Emory University. That conference, entitled "For the Trumpet Shall Sound, Protest, Prayer, and Prophecy," addressed the legacies of Thomas Merton and Martin Luther King, and featured, among many other scholars, Albert Rabiteau's reflection, "The Hidden Wholeness of Thomas Merton and Martin Luther King." And Rabiteau's reflection is published in his book, A Fire in the Bones, Reflections on African American Religious History. While I had first encountered Rabiteau's scholarship on slavery religion in college, he also inspired new generations of scholars who have taught us immensely about two critical facts of the history of African slaves in America: that they were full of agency in the midst of slavery, which is demonstrated by how they have revolutionized our understanding of the meaning of Christianity and democracy itself. Like many others, I was also inspired by his reflection on how Martin Luther King was planning to join Merton for a retreat at Gethsemane that was being planned before Dr. King was assassinated. The possibilities of joining the contemplative and the prophetic still stand before us today. Most importantly, by taking up Rabiteau's challenge to attempt to walk the path of contemplation and prophecy, I embarked upon an unexpected journey of confronting my own complicity in U.S. racism. Now, there was a recent reflection by, I believe it was Judith Vellante, on Merton on Silence, and she considered whether or not Merton would tweet. Now, I don't know if Merton would tweet, but he offers us a kind of tweet in the form of the epigraph to Seeds of Destruction. And that epigraph is Romans 9:22, which reads, "What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience the vessels of wrath made for destruction?" Now, as I prepared this talk, I thought, okay, I don't remember him ever referring to Romans 9:22, and there must be some place in Seeds of Destruction where he goes back to this epigraph. He doesn't. And so I wonder if he's inviting us just to be with Romans 9:22 as we take up the argument of his book. So my reflection tonight envisions how we might draw upon Merton's contemplative prophetic witness to address enduring white racial domination in the United States today. I owe a special debt to three scholars who have previously given this lecture: Albert Riboto, M. Sean Copeland, and Father Brian Massengale. I devote this lecture tonight to their witness and our shared struggle for racial justice. Merton's address to white people of faith, I believe, offers a spiritual path, a way where we may yet take up our baptismal calling responsibility to address the wound that is racism in America today. And I address myself first. That is to say, if I've learned anything from Merton, it is that I am in need of conversion and collaboration, and especially conversation with you, which I look forward to tonight, to consider how we might take up Merton's call to live more deeply in the mystical body of Christ. So you have an outline. If everyone, I hope everyone has the outline so you can follow my train of thought. I'm beginning by taking up the context of Merton's letters to a white liberal. When Merton wrote his letters to a white liberal in early summer of 1963, he was addressing a context that was full of crisis, precisely because dominant white society was overwhelmingly comfortable with the status quo. Dr. Martin Luther King had been jailed for protesting the unbearable conditions of Jim Crow terror in the South. When Dr. King penned his letter from Birmingham jail on April 16, 1963, recall that he addressed that letter to 8 white clergy leaders, including a rabbi and a Roman Catholic bishop. The 8 white clergymen appealed to law and order, urging an end to civil disobedience being used to end Jim Crow. They called the nonviolent demonstrations extreme measures. They asserted that outside agitators were creating racial disorder in Birmingham. The clergymen recommended instead patient negotiation and legal action to end any perceived denial of legal rights to blacks. Dr. King acknowledged his brothers and their concerns. Point by point, King patiently illuminated how the clergymen were complicit in the injustice of the status quo. He expressed sadness that they did not articulate any concern about the injustice that led to the protests or how police violently targeted African Americans. King's response conveyed the enduring prophetic message that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. However enduring and prophetic Dr. King's message is, it was not gaining a hearing in dominant white society. Merton, however, was moved enough to write his letters to a white liberal, an overt reference to Dr. King's confession of disappointment in the white moderate, who is a greater stumbling block to freedom than the Ku Klux Klanner. The white moderate, King exclaimed, was more devoted to order than justice and preferred a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, than to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, and who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. In addition to drawing from Dr. King's letter, it is difficult to miss the profound influence of James Baldwin. The language and argument that Merton follows in Seeds of Destruction closely mirror Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. It is not permissible that the authors of devastation should also be innocent. It is the innocence which constitutes the crime. So wrote James Baldwin in an open letter to his nephew entitled, My Dungeon Shook, Letter to My Nephew on the 100th Anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, which constitutes the first part of The Fire Next Time. Baldwin introduces his nephew to what sociologist E. Franklin Frazier called cities of destruction. Simply put, cities of destruction isolate and impoverish Black Americans and communicate a devastating message. Black lives do not count. Black survival means learning to affirm your own dignity and worth as the white world threatens it. The entire white world, the norms by which white Christian churches and society live, create death and destruction for people of color as whites live a fantasy of innocence and superiority. Thomas Merton took Baldwin's point to heart. The title of his 1964 book, Seeds of Destruction, interconnects Frazier's Cities of Destruction with white superiority. Merton intentionally invites a contrast between his book Seeds of Destruction and his earlier Seeds of Contemplation. Just as contemplation is ultimately rooted in the heart and spiritual practices of love, so the seeds of destruction are rooted in people's hearts and in spiritual practices that create relationships of superiority and inferiority. In other words, destruction is not only about weapons that people use to maim, kill, and destroy other human beings. Cities, indeed our entire society, reveal who we are as a people because they show where and how people live, worship, and die, and they communicate who we do and do not value. Merton saw this violent reality in our culture and sought to address the profoundly relational dimension of who we are as a people. So what does Merton mean by white liberal? He does not mean only partisan progressives. He has a much broader view in mind with this term. He means any white person, especially Christians, who claim good intentions toward all people, especially African Americans. This definition is critical for understanding his analysis of white superiority. So Merton starts with moral complicity. Seeds begins by noting that the contemplative life is not an abstraction or a flight from the world. The contemplative life is not and cannot be, Merton begins, a mere withdrawal, a pure negation, a turning of one's back on the world with its sufferings, its crises, its confusions and errors. Monastic communities are fully implicated in the sinfulness of the world, Merton explains, and they must witness to a baptismal conversion into God's love in the midst of worldly egoism and injustice. To forget or ignore one's implication in the sin and injustice of the world, continues Merton, does not absolve the monk from responsibility in events in which his very silence and not knowing may constitute a form of complicity. And practicing silence does not disconnect one from time and place. On the contrary, silence connects us with the whole of reality, including the time and place in which we live. At the very outset of Seeds, Merton recalls 20th century history, when monastic communities remained silent in Europe in the first half of the 20th century. Merton notices that too often they were publicly giving support to totalitarian movements. such otherworldly recollection and renunciation itself becomes complicit in the evil of the world. On the other hand, Merton does not join any partisan political cause. He is clear that monks should be free of the confusions and falsities of partisan dispute. The last thing he would want, he exclaims, is a monastic movement in politics. However, the contemplative ought not concentrate only upon ideal essences, upon absolutes, upon eternity alone. Even today, when a therapeutic spirituality sells, when spirituality tends to be overly concerned with making individuals feel better with themselves and comfortable with the status quo, Merton's warning endures. Christianity, he writes, cannot reject history. In fact, Christianity is centered upon an historical event that changes the entire meaning of time and history. This means that the freedom of the Christian contemplative is not freedom from time, but rather it is freedom in time. So he writes, "It is the freedom to go out and meet God in the inscrutable mystery of his will here and now, in this precise moment in which he asks man's cooperation in shaping the course of history according to the demands of divine truth, mercy, and fidelity. Contemplatives, lay and monastic, are called to witness to God's mercy, truth, and justice in the midst of earthly conflict. The adversary is not time or history. The adversary is evil will and the accumulated inheritance of untruth and past sin. Merton recognizes how we are individually and collectively shaped by society and the history of sin that precedes us." So although he does not advocate political partisanship, he states that I not only speak as a monk, but also as a responsible citizen of a very powerful nation. His point is not that the secular nation state ought to be guided by the church. However, he continues that if he is to live a vow of poverty, it seems illusory if I do not in some way identify myself with the cause of people who are denied their rights and forced, for the most part, to live in abject misery. To have a vow of obedience seems to me absurd if it does not imply a deep concern for the most fundamental of all expressions in God's will, the love of his truth and of our neighbor. So turning to what does he mean by seeds of destruction? The seeds of destruction Merton identifies include the illusion of white superiority and innocence. Second, the illusion of self-sufficiency and the ways that we prioritize profit over people. And three, white fears and projections, which ultimately result in a false sense of reality, a false sense of self and others, and also a false faith. All of these alienate us and destroy society. They wound the mystical body of Christ and tear all of us apart from God and neighbor. As long as white society remains attached to the status quo and views itself as the only acceptable reality, Merton finds, then the problem remains without solution and there will inevitably be violence. So recall how Merton drew upon Baldwin, who argued white innocence constitutes the crime. The story of innocence we tell ourselves renders the most basic questioning of white privilege and systemic racism invisible for critical reflection. It is not only that whites tend to live by the myth of American innocence, but that we also live by a myth of Christian innocence. Even as we may affirm universal human dignity, white racial bias is shaped by Christian imagery of good and evil, in which white equals innocent and black equals guilty. In the core argument of our book, The Scandal of White Complicity in U.S. Hyperincarceration, my co-authors and I argue, is an implicit theology and spiritual practice of black guilt and white innocence. In America, the rhetoric of innocence is associated with white. This assumption implicitly invokes that which is guilty is black. This practice subverts any claim that human beings are made in the image and likeness of God. The assumption of white racial innocence also means that white people who claim to follow the nonviolent Jesus, who claim to be committed to peace through justice, including those of us who follow Merton, can do so without ever addressing the violence that people of color confront every day in America. Merton indicts white American Catholicism. And I quote, "To assume the superiority of the white race and of European American culture as axiomatic, and to proceed from there to integrate all other races and cultures by a purely one-sided operation is a pure travesty of Catholic unity in truth." Naming this fake Catholicism, Merton contends that we live by a parody of unity that is no unity at all, but a one-sided attempt to reduce others to a condition of identity with ourselves, is one of the most disastrous misconceptions. Like Dr. King's analysis of the triple evils of racism, militarism, and consumerism, so Merton sees white racism as intimately intertwined with militarism and the American propensity to put profit before people. White prosperity is rooted in racial injustice and sin. The real tragedy, he writes, is that the white man who does not realize that though he seems to himself to be free, he is actually the victim of the same servitudes which he has imposed on the Negro. Passive subjection to a lotus-eating commercial society that he has tried to create for himself and which is shot through with falsity and unfreedom from top to bottom. So this situation, Merton believes, gives rise to a tougher Negro leadership, to use his language, no longer moderate and nonviolent, and much more likely to utilize the threat of force represented in the critical mass of frustrated, angry, and jobless African Americans in cities across the nation. Sporadic violence ought to be expected, Merton says, even if it is labeled as delinquency rather than overt revolution. Like Martin Luther King, Merton acknowledges that delinquency itself is a spontaneous form of non-political protest and revolt. It is an expression of deeper suffering and injustice. A more deadly, more violent situation was being fomented by a combination of three forces. First, overt Southern racists became entrenched in their refusals against universal dignity and rights. Southern white society, Merton recognized, itself felt faced with destruction. Southern society, says Merton, feels menaced in its own being, even if its self-image and view of reality is false. We know from experience with other notorious forms of fanaticism, Merton reflects, that societies that experience their reality on this psychopathic level are precisely those whose members are most convinced of their own rightness, of their own integrity, indeed their own complete infallibility. It is this experience of unreality as real and as something to be defended against objective facts and rights, as though against the devil himself, that produces the inferno of racism and conflict. Secondly, African Americans rightfully became more determined to assert their own power, including the use of force if necessary. Merton recognized that as violence was used against African Americans organizing for the right to vote, and that because the vote would take time to create change, that such violence only encourages African Americans to prefer bullets to ballots. Third, and perhaps the most deadly piece of the mix of destructive seeds, stood white liberals. Good intentions are not enough. As African Americans and other people of color have expressed for centuries, good intentions may only hide a more subtle form of white superiority. A false sense of reality as well as of religious faith plants seeds of destruction deep in the soil of American churches and society. Today, Merton's insight into this violence seems prescient. Where minds are full of hatred and where imaginations dwell on cruelty, torment, punishment, revenge, and death, then inevitably there will be violence and death. So I want to turn to the contemporary context that sometimes we refer to as racism without racists. Recall that the same year that Merton wrote his letters to a white liberal, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom created one of the most successful mass mobilizations in U.S. history, drawing over 250,000 participants. A. Philip Randolph, who had been advocating for civil and economic rights since 1917, first launched the March on Washington movement in 1941. While we celebrate equal access to public accommodations, interracial marriage and families, laws against racial discrimination and employment, and black voting rights attained through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, although these are under assault today, the key economic, housing, and education goals of the 1963 March on Washington remain unrealized. A recent Pew Research study finds that the current wealth gap between whites and blacks has reached its highest point since 1989, when whites had 17 times the wealth of black households. Likewise, the wealth of white households is more than 10 times that of Hispanic, compared to 9 times in 2010. And although the U.S. Supreme Court decided that school segregation was unconstitutional and inherently unequal in 1954, a recent national study finds that the typical black student is now in a school where almost 2 out of every 3 classmates, 64%, are low income, nearly double the levels of schools of a typical white or Asian student. ProPublica found that in 1972, due to strong federal enforcement, only about 25% of black students in the South attended intensely segregated schools in which 9 out of 10 students were racial minorities. However, in districts released from federal court orders between 1990 and 2011, 53% of black students attend such schools. Now, these numbers need to be understood in a context in which white Americans self-segregate more than any other racial ethnic group. The Public Religion Research Institute's 2013 American Values Survey reveals that 75% of white Americans have fully white social networks with no people of color. As Merton recognized, and I quote, "Integration is always going to be not on our street, but somewhere else." The March on Washington also demanded a national minimum wage of $2 per hour, which is $13 per hour in today's dollars. After adjusting for inflation, the minimum wage today, $7.25, is worth $2 less than in 1968 when Dr. King was advocating for the sanitation workers in Memphis. Since Dr. King was assassinated, the income gap between blacks and whites has narrowed by just 3 cents on the dollar. At this rate of progress, racial equality, income equality, will not be met for 537 years. These inequalities are compounded by a system of mass incarceration. Michelle Alexander calls America's incarceration regime the new Jim Crow because we have not ended racial caste in America, we have merely redesigned it. We incarcerate African Americans at a rate higher than apartheid South Africa. The United States, with less than 6% of global population, accounts for 25% of all people incarcerated in the world. Between 1980 and 2000, the number of people incarcerated increased from roughly 300,000 to 2 million people. There are now over 7 million people in the criminal justice system. The vast majority of these have been for nonviolent offenses. And consider police violence. About twice a week or every 3 or 4 days, an African American has been killed by a white police officer, explains Isabel Wilkerson, citing Federal Bureau of Investigation data. The banality of this reality, she observes, obscures the fact that this is nearly the same rate at which African Americans were being lynched in the early 20th century. In her call to Americans to own up to our own violence, Wilkerson details the uncanny similarities between lynching and the police shooting of Michael Brown, not the least significant of which is the fact that the lynched body was sometimes left hanging for days or weeks as a lesson for people to not step outside the caste into which they had been born. Michael Brown's body, recall, was left in the street for over 4 hours, where his mother and relatives were not allowed to be near his body. Despite these glaring racial disparities, we now live in the absurdity of racism without racists. The sociologist Eduardo Bonilla Silva utilizes this term, racism without racists, to describe a society that reduces racism to overt acts of individual malice as it ignores how we reproduce white dominance. The way we culturally value whiteness and criminalize blackness belies any notion that we live in a so-called post-racial society. As Merton recognized, the problem is deeper. Not only are white Americans unable to see our own racial bias, we also tend to live by the myth that we are racially innocent. Lori Cassidy, Margaret File, and I entitled our book, The Scandal of White Complicity, for this very reason. extending Merton's point theologically, all people are good by the fact of being made in the image and likeness of God. Every person is a gift of God's creation. Inherent in that gift is moral responsibility. It is for this theological and practical reason that people who may be otherwise morally upright may miss how racism addresses us as white people. The journalist Todd Nahisi Coates contends that while we focus on overt acts of individual malice, racism, elegant, lovely, monstrous, carries on. Coates describes a brand of systemic racism more sophisticated than that demonstrated by overt racists. He notices how elegant racism is invisible, supple, enduring. It disguises itself in the national vocabulary, avoids epithets and didacticism. Grace is the singular marker of elegant racism. The grace of this racism is how it employs lobbyists dressed in the finest suits, lives in neighborhoods with manicured lawns, and includes the most active citizens who vote for judges, legislators, district attorneys, and policies that maintain white innocence as we criminalize blacks. The attractive goods of school and neighborhood choice often hide in very subtle ways the ways that white Americans withdraw funding and resources from cities and communities of colors for school, housing, healthcare, transportation, and jobs. Elegant racism does not require that a realtor tell a black person that they cannot buy a specific property, nor does it require that white people consciously seek out a white realtor to help them find a predominantly white neighborhood. The discriminatory operations of our law, economy, and real estate render such explicit, overtly racist personal interactions unnecessary. The law places the onus on proving intentional racist intent to exclude a person from renting or buying a property, a legal measure that is extremely difficult to demonstrate. So people, we don't need to state that location, location, location means white location, white location, white location. This supple evasion ignores the linkage between home ownership and the relative valuing of whiteness over blackness. When whites own a home earlier in life and gain more home equity over a lifetime than do people of color. Sophisticated racism ignores how African American and Latino borrowers are more likely to receive subprime loans than white borrowers, even when studies are controlled for legitimate risk factors. Predatory payday lenders, without any hint of racism, frequently locate their shops in the most economically vulnerable communities of color. So I turn to Merton's Seeds of Contemplation and Liberation. Merton believed that the nation stood at a societal impasse that demanded the transformation of society. And I think what I've only begun to describe about conditions today, that we're in a situation of new seeds of destruction that might be deeper and more pervasive than what Merton was contending in the early 60s. As Sean Copeland argues, the condition of the possibility of freedom for people of color in the United States is full justice and equality. Now recall Merton's tweet that I mentioned earlier, his epigraph that quotes Romans 9:22. Again, it reads, "What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience the vessels of wrath made for destruction?" Although Merton never explicitly returns to Romans 9:22 in Seeds of Destruction, he does address the same issue in a journal entry for October 24th, 1963, which was at the same time that he was preparing Seeds of Destruction for book publication. So in that journal entry of October 24th, he quotes the German theologian Karl Barth. And it was Barth who wrote, "To be a man means to be situated in God's presence as Jesus is. That is, to be a bearer of the wrath of God." Reflecting on Barth, Merton wrote this in his journal. "We need the shock of this sentence, which of course is immediately qualified by Barth himself. And the qualification is implicit, for Jesus bears that wrath and lives. But the wrath is on us." So we can discuss Merton's tweet or his epigraph. But I think what Merton is doing is inviting us to contemplatively confront our complicity in racial violence in America and embrace the mystical body of Christ. The ascetic discipline of dying to self is at the heart of a nonviolent spirituality of resistance to racism. As Brian Massengale put it, racial solidarity is a paschal experience, one that entails a dying of a false sense of self and a renunciation of racial privilege so as to rise to a new identity and status that is God-given. In the Birmingham civil rights protests, Merton found a call to white people to embark upon personal conversion and structural transformation. If white people were truly to internalize this loving, courageous witness, Merton was convinced, they would cease to be the people they were. They would have to die to everything that was familiar and secure. They would have to die to their past, to their society with its prejudices and inertia, die to its false beliefs. In Merton's estimation, a genuine white response to African Americans' thirst for love and justice must consist of two things, and I quote, "First, a complete reform of the social system which permits and breeds such injustices. And second, this work of reorganization must be carried out under the inspiration of the Negro, whose providential time has now arrived and who has received from God enough light, ardor, and spiritual strength to free the white man in freeing himself from the white man." Goodwill and charity are insufficient. Merton does not question white sincerity or generosity. Rather, creating social, political, and economic structures that are just is constitutive of being transformed into God's love for the world. Even work for justice is insufficient without Merton's second point, a profound turning to African Americans in their experience, wisdom, and truth. Merton calls whites to practice Christ's kingdom of humility by turning our full attention to people of color in the fullness of their humanity, as they are, not as whites imagine, fear, wish, or project them to be. Merton illumines how humility frees one to renounce the protection of violence and risk being humble, therefore vulnerable, not because he trusts in the supposed efficacy of a gentle and persuasive tactic that will disarm hatred and tame cruelty, but because he believes that the hidden power of the gospel is demanding to be manifested in and through his poor person. This practice of humility joins obedience to God with the great commandments to join love of God and love of neighbor. The purpose of humility is not simply to edify or to develop my own relationship to God. Rather, humility opens us to alternatives offered by the Spirit and Christ's kingdom in relationship with other people. Hence, Merton writes, in perfect obedience to the gospel, he effaces himself and his own interests and even risks his life in order to testify not simply to the truth in a sweeping, idealistic, and purely Platonic sense, but to the truth that is incarnate in a concrete human situation involving living persons whose rights are denied or whose lives are threatened. Practicing Christ's humility means that whites need to learn from African Americans about the ways that we whites are imprisoned both to false idealization of ourselves as racially innocent and to false demonization of African Americans. Merton invites white Americans to see ourselves as African Americans have seen and experienced us through history. When whites see ourselves as African Americans do, then we may see where Jesus stands. Jesus, as the one who bears the violent wrath of dominant society, stands with the demonized as a way of calling us to transformation through lived solidarity. Thus, Merton specifically invites white Americans to listen to the freedom and gospel songs, to read King's letter from Birmingham jail, and James Baldwin's prophetic books, among many others. Turning to African Americans means breaking down white boundaries and embracing our shared humanity. It means attending to the experience and wisdom of our Muslim brothers and sisters, including Malcolm X. This also means listening to contemporary perspectives, such as hip-hop, as my colleague Lori Cassidy writes in our recent book. Ultimately, Christ's love invites humility before all others who have given us life and who reveals God's infinite love for the world. The wound that is racism in America afflicts us all. Thomas Merton offers a path, I believe, rooted in contemplative prophetic practice, whereby we may yet taste and see the possibilities of God's beloved community. May we join together on this path, including here at Bellarmine, so that we might yet realize the African American wisdom that God makes a way where there is no way. Then we may truly honor Thomas Merton on the centenary of his birth. Then we may yet walk the way of the light of love of neighbor, where we enter Christ, our shared light and love, and walk the only way of hope for liberation and salvation. Amen.